Before we get completely derailed today, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. And you know, they've got a full Series 63 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flash cards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's actually super helpful. So go check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's a really solid resource for this stuff.
Totally. Okay, so usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there is a very clear expectation of precision, right? You break your arm, you go to the hospital, and the x-ray shows this jagged white line across the bone.
Right. It's undeniable.
Yeah, exactly. The doctor just points at the screen and says, there it is. It's binary. It's super clean. You either have a broken arm or you don't.
Which is comforting, honestly. I mean, human beings inherently like things to be visible. We like things perfectly categorized into, you know, neat little boxes.
We really do.
But I do.
But then, well, then you step out of the hospital and into the world of legal definitions and financial regulations, and suddenly that x-ray machine is completely useless.
Oh, yeah. It just breaks down entirely.
Right. You try to look at a financial transaction to see if it's like a security or just a normal business deal, and the x-ray is just blurry. We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is, quite honestly, incredibly murky.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. And, you know, those waters are exactly where the entire regulatory framework of the United States financial system lives.
Which is exactly where we are living today. Because our mission for this deep dive is mastering the vocabulary of the Uniform Securities Act, what we'll just call the USA, specifically tailored for those of you preparing for the Series 63 exam.
Yeah, and this is crucial for the exam.
It is, and I want to speak directly to you, the listener, right now. I know what your goal is. You need to deeply learn, retain, and actually apply this information under intense ticking clock exam conditions.
Right. Like, you can't just casually recognize a term on a flashcard.
Exactly. You have to know the underlying mechanics of these laws in your bones.
And, I mean, this goes way beyond memorizing a glossary. The entire architecture of the exam hinges on these foundational definitions. If you don't know exactly what the law means when it uses a highly specific word like person or sale, every single question that follows is just going to feel like a trap.
And we know how dry legal textbooks can be. I mean, I have ADHD, so if you just read a textbook at me, or if I have to sit through monotonous lectures that sound like someone reading a dictionary, I will literally go into a coma.
Yeah, standard legal definitions are brutal for that.
They really are. So we're setting some ground rules for our conversation today. We are totally throwing out the textbook approach. I'm going to bring in absurd analogies. We're going to explore the actual, often bizarre historical events that forced regulators to write these laws in the first place.
Which are surprisingly entertaining.
They are. And I want to throw direct pop quizzes at you where you actually have to pause and think through the mechanics of a rule. And most importantly, we are going to explicitly call out every single trick, every subtle gotcha that the exam writers just love to use to prey on your assumptions.
To make this work, though, we need test subjects, right? We need a way to visualize these really dry concepts in the real world.
Exactly. So we are introducing a recurring cast of characters who are going to basically suffer through these legal definitions for our amusement.
I love it. Who do we have?
Okay. First, we have Frank the founder. Frank is perpetually trying to start bizarre, highly questionable businesses.
Okay. Frank the founder. Got it.
Then we have Dave the dentist. Dave is this hardworking guy with some extra cash who just wants to invest, but he gets easily confused by complex financial wrappers.
Right. He's our everyman investor.
Yeah, exactly. And finally, we have Paula the promoter. Paula is, you know, always hustling. She's always trying to sell questionable financial products to Dave while skirting the edge of the law.
Frank, Dave, and Paula. Perfect. They will be our proxies for navigating the Uniform Securities Act.
Okay, let's unpack this and jump right into the deep end. Before the law can regulate a trade, before it can investigate fraud or demand a registration fee, it has to establish jurisdiction, right?
Exactly. It has to know who is playing the game.
Right. And under the USA, that starts with defining a person. Now, looking at this source material, the definition of a person seems almost laughably broad. I mean, you look in the mirror, you are a person. Dave the dentist is a person. Why do regulators need pages of legal text to define something a literal toddler understands?
Well, it's because the legal concept of a person under the Uniform Securities Act has very little to do with biology and everything to do with regulatory capture.
Meaning what? Exactly.
Meaning, if you are not a person under the law, the USA literally does not care about you. You exist totally outside its jurisdiction. You could commit the most egregious financial fraud in history, And the state securities administrator couldn't even touch you.
Because they only have the legal authority to regulate persons.
Precisely. So regulators intentionally engineered the definition to be this inescapable net.
Okay, so cast the net for me. Who is in it?
Under the USA, a person means an individual, what the law calls a natural person. So that's human beings. You, me, Dave, Paula.
Right. Normal people.
But it dramatically expands from there. It includes corporations, partnerships, associations, joint stock companies, and unincorporated organizations.
Okay, I follow the logic there.
Right.
If Frank the founder realizes he is personally regulated, his very first instinct will be to incorporate Frank's Shady Ventures LLC and try to conduct his fraud through the company.
Exactly. And by making the corporation a person, the law traps the entity itself.
So the law treats Dave the Dentist and Dave's Dental LLC as two distinct, fully regulated persons.
Yes. But it goes even further. The definition also includes governments and political subdivisions of a government.
Hey, wait, pause on that. This is where my intuition just completely hits a wall. The literal city of Denver is a person.
It is.
If Denver wants to build a new subway system and they need to raise capital, the Uniform Securities Act looks at a sprawling metropolis of millions of people and says, ah, yes, a person.
How does a city function as a person mechanically?
Think about what happens when a city builds that subway. They don't have the cash on hand, right?
Yeah.
So they issue municipal bonds.
They are borrowing money from investors, promising to pay it back with interest funded by future tax revenues. In that specific transaction, the city of Denver is creating a financial instrument and offering it to the public. They are acting as an issuer.
And only a person can legally be an issuer.
Right. If the law didn't classify the government entity as a person, then the city could issue fraudulent bonds, lie on their financial disclosures, and the securities regulators would have zero authority to enforce anti-fraud provisions against them.
Wow. Okay, so calling a city a person is just the legal mechanism required to hold them accountable when they step into the financial market.
Exactly. It's purely functional.
That makes perfect sense when you look at the mechanics of issuing debt. So the net is massive.
It's individual.
Those businesses, governments. But looking at the source material, there's a very specific carve-out regarding trusts.
Ah, yes. The trust exception.
Because people set up trusts all the time for estate planning, right? Let's say Dave the Dentist has a really good year. He takes $1 million, puts it into a standard family trust, and names his 10-year-old son Timmy as the beneficiary.
Right.
The trust holds the money until Timmy turns 25. Is that garden variety family trust a person?
This is one of the few areas where the net does not catch the entity. A garden variety family trust, like the one Dave just set up for Timmy, is not a person under the USA.
But why? It's a legal entity holding money. Why does the USA just let it slip by?
Because of what the trust is actually doing, the USA is fundamentally concerned with the issuance and trading of securities.
Okay.
In Dave's family trust, he is just passing his own private wealth to his own private child. The trust is not raising capital from the public. It is not issuing shares of itself to outside investors.
So it's just a private container.
Right. However, the law explicitly states that a trust is a person only if the interests of the beneficiaries are evidenced by a security.
Give me a mechanical breakdown of what that looks like.
Well,
how does a trust evidence a beneficiary interest with a security?
Imagine a massive Wall Street firm creates a trust. And instead of holding Dave's private money for his kid, this trust goes out and buys thousands of different mortgages.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. Then the trust chops up the right to receive the income from those mortgages into thousands of little pieces, prints up certificates representing those pieces, and sells them to the public.
Like a mortgage-backed security or a unit investment trust.
Exactly. In that scenario, the trust is essentially acting like a corporation. It is issuing beneficiary interests, those certificates, that are openly traded as securities. Because it's operating in the public financial markets issuing securities, that specific type of business trust, IS a person.
So if the trust is just a private wealth transfer vehicle for a family, not a person, but if the trust is slicing up assets and selling tradable certificates to the public, it is a person.
That is the exact dividing line. You nailed it.
Awesome. Now, listeners, I want you to mentally highlight this next concept because I'm looking at the exam prep notes. And this is just a glaring neon red trap.
It really is. They catch so many people on this.
The exam writers absolutely love to prey on your common sense when it comes to the definition of a person. They will present you with a list and ask, which of the following is not a person? And they will include options like a minor, a deceased individual, or a mentally incompetent individual.
And your human intuition will scream at you. You'll look at a five-year-old child and think, a kindergartner cannot possibly be a legal person engaging in complex securities transactions.
Right. Or you'll see a deceased individual and think, well, they are dead. They literally do not exist anymore. They cannot be a person.
Exactly.
Like if Dave the dentist sadly passes away in a freak flossing accident, my brain says Dave is no longer a person. But under the USA,
Dave is still a person. The statutory definition of a person does not exclude deceased individuals, minors, or the mentally incompetent.
I need you to explain the underlying logic here because it feels so counterintuitive. How can a deceased guy or a toddler be regulated by a Securities Act?
It feels counterintuitive because the exam writers are deliberately exploiting your confusion between two entirely separate legal concepts.
Okay, what are they?
Statutory personhood and legal capacity. Let's break them down. Statutory personhood is simply the state of being an individual or an entity recognized by the law.
Which they all are.
Right. Legal capacity, on the other hand, is a much narrower concept. It is your legal ability to enter into a binding, enforceable contract.
Ah, so a five-year-old child is undeniably a human being. Therefore, they are an individual and they meet the definition of a person.
Yes.
But because they are five, they lack the legal capacity to sign a brokerage agreement and execute a stock trade.
Precisely. If five-year-old Timmy inherits a massive stock portfolio, Timmy is a person who owns securities. The state administrator still has absolute jurisdiction over those assets to ensure they aren't being mismanaged or defrauded by a broker.
So Timmy is protected.
Yes, Timmy just can't execute trades himself. He needs a legal guardian to act on his behalf.
And the same logic applies to Dave passing away.
Yes. When Dave dies, he doesn't retroactively evaporate from the legal system. His estate still holds all of his stocks, bonds, and mutual funds.
Right.
The USA needs to maintain jurisdiction over Dave's account to regulate how the broker-dealer handles those assets while the estate is settled. Dave remains a person on paper. His executor just handles the physical transactions because Dave lacks capacity.
The law never says an individual unless they are dead. It just says an individual. Therefore, they are always a person. That is a brilliant distinction. Statutory personhood versus legal capacity to contract. Do not mix them up.
That's the golden rule for that section.
All right, listener, I am throwing a pop quiz at you right now. Stop whatever you are doing, whether you're walking the dog or doing dishes, and visualize this. You are sitting in the exam center. The timer is ticking.
The pressure is on.
The question on the screen reads, under the Uniform Securities Act, which of the following is not considered a person? Here we go.
Option A, a municipality. Option B, a corporation. Option C, a mentally incompetent individual. Option D, a minor. I'm going to give you a B. Walk through the mechanics we just discussed. Which one do you cross out? Pause. Okay, what is the trap here?
The trap is that every single one of those options is a person.
It's a trick question.
It is a trick question construct we're using to hammer the concept home. In a real multiple choice scenario, if you are forced to pick what is not a person, you are hunting for that garden variety family trust, or perhaps something absurd like a pet dog or a completely non-existent entity.
Right.
But the city, the business, the incapacitated adult, the child, they are all firmly inside the regulatory net.
We have established who the law applies to. The players are on the board. We've got Frank, Dave, Paula, Dave's LLC, and the city of Denver. Now we have to figure out what they're actually trading.
Right, because if a person is just buying a sandwich, the USA doesn't care. Exactly. The transaction only triggers this massive regulatory apparatus if they are trading a specific type of asset. Which brings us to arguably the most critical definition in the entire legal framework. What is a security?
If you don't have a security, the Uniform Securities Act goes completely dormant.
Wow, completely dormant.
Yeah, the state administrator has no power, the anti-fraud provisions don't apply, and the registration requirements just vanish. Everything rests on this single definition.
I am looking at the source material, and the statutory definition is just a gigantic laundry list. It lists stocks, treasury stock, bonds, notes, debentures, evidence of indebtedness, certificates of interest and profit-sharing agreements, investment contracts. It just goes on and on.
It's exhausting to read. And frankly, you don't need to memorize every single word of that list.
Let's break down some of the jargon, though, because I don't want to just skip over words. Like, what exactly is a debenture? I hear that thrown around in finance movies all the time.
A debenture is simply a type of debt instrument that is not secured by physical collateral.
Not secured.
Okay. Yeah. So If a company issues a mortgage bond, the bond is backed by the physical building. If the company goes bankrupt, the bondholders get the building.
That makes sense.
But if a company issues a debenture, it is backed only by the general creditworthiness and reputation of the issuer. It is an unsecured loan.
So it's essentially a corporate IOU based on trust. Lend us money, we promise we're good for it.
Exactly. And because you are giving a company money in exchange for a promised return of interest, a debenture is clearly a security.
Okay, the list covers all the obvious stuff. But at the very end of the definition, there's this incredibly vague catch-all provision that says, in general, any interest or instrument commonly known as a security. Why do regulators need a vague catch-all if they just spend a massive paragraph listing every financial instrument under the sun?
Because human beings, especially promoters trying to separate investors from their money, are infinitely creative.
Oh, I bet.
Regulators know that if they only define a security as a stock or a bond, some clever lawyer will create a new investment vehicle, call it a synergistic profit-sharing glider, and argue that since the word glider isn't in the statute, it's not a security and therefore immune to regulation.
Oh, so they need a net that catches the concept, not just the vocabulary word.
Exactly. The courts and the regulators operate on a foundational legal principle called substance over form.
Substance over form.
They do not care what label you slap on the paperwork. The form is irrelevant. They care about the economic reality of the transaction, the substance. If the economic reality looks like an investment, acts like an investment, and carries the risks of an investment, the regulators are going to treat it as a security, regardless of what you named it.
Which perfectly transitions us into one of the most fascinating pieces of legal history I think we'll ever talk about on this show. Because the state-level USA mirrors the Federal Securities Act of 1933, state administrators rely heavily on federal case law to determine what falls into that vague catch-all bucket. And that reliance leads us straight to a Supreme Court case from 1946.
SEC v. W.J. Howie Co. It is the absolute cornerstone of modern securities law.
I want to spend some real time on this because the fact that we are using a 1946 dispute about literal Florida oranges to regulate 21st century cryptocurrency and digital fractional real estate,
yes,
is just amazing to me. Let's set the historical stage. What actually happened in the Howie case?
Okay, so William J. Howie owned a massive tract of citrus groves in Florida.
Oranges.
Right, oranges. He was a savvy businessman, and he realized he could raise capital by selling off scripts of his orange groves to the public. He owned a resort hotel nearby, which attracted wealthy tourists from out of state.
People who have money but no idea how to farm?
Exactly. A tourist from New York doesn't know the first thing about cultivating citrus. So Howie offered them a package deal. He would sell them a small strip of land, a physical real estate transaction.
Okay, that sounds normal.
But alongside the land deed, he heavily encouraged them to sign a 10-year service contract with his other company, Howie and the Hills Service, Inc.
And what did the service contract do?
The service contract gave Howie's company the exclusive right to cultivate the land, harvest the oranges, take them to market, sell them, and then pool all the profits and distribute them back to the landowners.
That is brilliant. The tourist gets to feel like a Florida landowner, but they don't have to lift a finger. They just wait for a check.
It was brilliant until the Securities and Exchange Commission showed up.
Oh.
The SEC looked at this arrangement and said, you aren't just selling real estate. You are selling unregistered securities.
And Howie probably argued, no, I'm not. Look at the paperwork. This is a real estate deed and this landscaping contract. Neither of those are stocks or bonds. It's not a security. He's arguing form over substance.
Right. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. The court had to figure out if this weird hybrid orange grove package fit into the catch-all category of an investment contract. To do that, they created a mechanical four-part test to determine the economic reality of the situation. We call it the Howie test.
Okay. Wake up. Listener, if you zoned out, come back to me. This is the most important framework in the entire episode. The Howie test has four distinct prongs, and this is vital. All four prongs must be met.
All four, not three.
Right. If a transaction meets three of them, but fails the fourth, it is not an investment contract and therefore not a security. Let's bring in Frank, the founder, to test this out.
Let's see what Frank is up to.
Frank is starting a highly questionable, totally unconventional business called Frank's Flying Ferrets.
Flying Ferrets, of course.
It is an elaborate traveling circus featuring acrobatic ferrets performing on tiny trapezes. Frank needs capital to build the ferret tents and buy ferret food. So he goes to Dave the dentist and asks for an investment.
And how does Dave feel about this?
Dave hates ferrets. He thinks they smell and he doesn't want anything to do with them. But Dave loves the idea of passive income. So Dave says, Frank, I will give you $50,000 to buy ferrets, but I refuse to touch them. You run the circus, you train the ferrets, you sell the tickets. Just send me my share of the profits every quarter.
This is the perfect modern hypothetical to run through the 1946 test. Let's look at the four prongs of Howie.
Hit me.
Prong one, is there an investment of money?
That seems straightforward. Dave handed Frank $50,000.
It is straightforward, but remember that the law broadly interprets money. It actually means an investment of any valuable consideration. It could be cash, it could be transferring physical property, it could even be providing a massive amount of free labor up front in exchange for a future payout.
Oh, wow.
But in this case, Dave gave cash. Prong one is easily satisfied.
Prong two, is there a common enterprise? Now, I need you to go deep on this one. The source material says a common enterprise means the investment is pooled with others in a shared venture, but then it uses these highly technical terms, horizontal commonality versus vertical commonality. What are the actual mechanics of these two concepts?
This is a nuanced area, and different federal courts interpret it slightly differently, but you need to understand both mechanisms. Common enterprise essentially asks, whose fortunes are tied together? Who shares the risk and the reward? Let's start with horizontal commonality. This is the most widely accepted standard. Horizontal commonality means the investors' fortunes are directly tied to each other through the pooling of assets.
Give me a mechanical analogy for that.
Imagine a massive syndicate betting on a horse race. Frank goes to Dave, Paula, and 10 other dentists and raises $50,000 from each of them. He pools all $600,000 into one giant bank account. He uses that giant pool of money to build the entire ferret circus.
So they're all in it together.
Exactly. If the circus is a massive hit, all 12 investors get a proportional return on their money. If the circus burns to the ground, all 12 investors lose their money at the exact same time. Their fortunes rise and fall together horizontally across the entire pool of investors. They share the exact same risk profile.
Okay, they're all in the exact same economic vehicle. If the vehicle crashes, everyone gets hurt. What is vertical commonality?
Vertical commonality looks at the relationship between the investor and the promoter, ignoring the other investors. It means the investor's fortune is tied directly to the promoter's success or failure.
How would that work with the ferrets?
Let's say Frank doesn't pool the money. Instead, Frank makes a specific, isolated deal with Dave. Frank says, Dave, your $50,000 is going to fund one specific star ferret named Barnaby. If Barnaby learns to do a triple backflip and becomes famous, you get rich. If Barnaby is lazy, you lose your money.
In that scenario, Dave's success has nothing to do with Paula's success because Paula might have funded a completely different ferret.
Exactly. Dave's fortune is strictly tied vertically to Frank's ability to train Barnaby. Most courts say that if you have either horizontal pooling or vertical reliance on the promoter, you have a common enterprise. In our main scenario, Dave's money is funding the whole circus. Prong two is met.
Awesome. Prong three, is there an expectation of profits?
This asks about the investor's motivation. Did Dave put his money in purely for personal consumption, or did he want a financial return? You specified that Dave hates ferrets and only wants passive income. He clearly expects a profit. Prong three is satisfied.
What if Dave just really loved ferrets and paid Frank $50,000 to build a private ferret sanctuary in Dave's backyard for him to just look at?
Then the motivation is personal use. There is no expectation of financial profit. The Howie test fails at prong three. It is not an investment contract. It's just a wildly expensive landscaping purchase.
Okay, but in our circus scenario, Dave wants money, so we move to the final hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
Prong four, are the profits derived from the efforts of others?
This is the prong that exam writers love to test the most because it hinges on the concept of active versus passive involvement. Where is the actual labor coming from to generate the return?
Right.
If Dave the dentist has to shut down his dental practice, travel with the circus, clean the cages every morning, and train the ferrets to jump through flaming hoops, then the profits are being generated by Dave's own blood, sweat, and tears.
And so?
In that case, prong four fails. He's not relying on the efforts of others. He just bought himself a terrible, smelly job.
But Dave explicitly told Frank, I refuse to touch them. You run the circus.
Exactly. The success of the enterprise depends entirely on Frank's management, Frank's marketing, and Frank's ferret whispering skills. Dave is completely passive. He relies entirely on the efforts of a third party. Prong four is satisfied.
Money invested, common enterprise,
yeah.
Expectation of profit, efforts of others, all four prongs are met, the economic reality is clear. Boom. Day's $50,000 stake in Frank's Flying Ferrets is an investment contract. It is a security.
Yes, it is.
And Frank just committed a massive felony by offering an unregistered security to Dave without a license.
It happens every day in the real world.
I want to dig into the history of Prong 4 a bit more, because the source material mentions a subtle shift in the legal language that the exam loves to test. The original 1946 Supreme Court ruling said the profits had to come solely from the efforts of others. But modern courts have adjusted that word from solely to primarily or substantially. Why did the courts have to change the wording of their own test?
Because of that infinite human creativity we talked about earlier. Promoters realized that if the test required the profits to come solely, meaning 100% from the efforts of others, they could engineer a loophole.
Oh, I can see where this is going.
Imagine Frank reads the 1946 Howey decision. He goes back to Dave and says, look, to avoid the SEC, we need you to do a tiny bit of work, so I'm not doing 100% of it. I'm going to install a big red button in your dental office. Once a year, you have to press the button. That button sends an automated email to the circus staff. Because you pressed the button, you contributed labor. Therefore, the profits didn't come solely from me. We beat the Howey test.
That is hilarious, but I can totally see a lawyer arguing that in court.
They absolutely did argue things like that. For decades, promoters of pyramid schemes and weird franchise agreements would force investors to do token, meaningless tasks just to break the solely requirement.
So what did the courts do?
Eventually, the courts got sick of it. They looked at the economic reality and said, this is absurd. Pressing a button once a year is a sham. So they modernized the rule. They said the profits must come primarily or substantially from the managerial or entrepreneurial efforts of others.
So if Dave does 1% of the work by pressing a button, but Frank is doing 99% of the heavy lifting, the actual entrepreneurial effort that drives the revenue, it still counts as relying on the efforts of others. The test holds, and it still is security.
Exactly. The courts closed the token labor loophole.
Let's pivot slightly and talk about notes. A note is essentially an IOU. It is a written promise from one party to pay a specific sum of money to another party. The source material has a massive gotcha warning attached to this topic. It's a simple IOU, a security.
The legal framework starts with a very strong assumption. Under the USA, a note is presumed to be a security. That is your baseline starting position for every scenario.
Okay, presumed to be a security.
However, that presumption is rebuttable. That means you can bring evidence to prove the presumption false. The presumption is rebutted if the note strongly resembles a type of loan that is obviously commercial or consumer in nature rather than an investment.
Give me a real-world scenario where the presumption is successfully rebutted.
Let's say Dave the dentist and Frank the founder have been best friends since college. Frank is going through a tough time and can't make rent. Dave writes Frank a personal check for $1,000 to help him out. Frank grabs a napkin and writes, I, Frank, promise to pay Dave $1,000 next month.
Just a simple favor.
Right. That is a note. But the economic reality is that it's a short-term personal consumer loan between friends to facilitate daily living expenses. It is not designed to raise risk capital for a business enterprise. The presumption is successfully rebutted. That napkin IOU is not a security.
What about a mortgage? I signed a massive promissory note when I bought my house.
A note secured by a residential mortgage is another classic example of rebutting the presumption. It is a standard consumer financing transaction backed by physical real estate, not a speculative investment relying on the managerial efforts of a promoter, not a security.
Okay, but what if Frank realizes he can't get a bank loan for the ferret circus?
Yeah.
So he prints up 500 glossy, professional-looking promissory notes. The notes promise a massive 15% annual interest rate. He runs ads online and sells these notes to hundreds of strangers across the country to fund his circus equipment.
Look at the economic reality there. Frank is raising capital for a speculative business enterprise. He is marketing these instruments to the general public as a high-yield investment. The buyers are completely reliant on Frank's ability to run the business to generate the cash flow needed to pay that 15% interest.
So it passes the Howey test.
Exactly. In that scenario, all the characteristics point to an investment contract.
Yeah.
The presumption holds firm. Those notes are absolutely securities, and Frank is committing fraud if they aren't registered.
I love how the Howey framework just naturally cuts through the nonsense. It forces you to look at the actual mechanics of the money.
It's a very elegant test.
Now, the Howey test is great for catching the weird, unconventional stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The ferret farms, the crypto staking pools, the fractional real estate apps. But the exam is not always going to give you weird stuff. In fact, a huge chunk of the exam is going to throw a rapid-fire list of incredibly normal-sounding financial products at you, and you have to instantly know, security or security?
And this is where the exam writers are arguably their most devious. They love to pair two financial products that sound almost identical to the layperson, but have completely divergent legal classifications based on who bears the underlying risk.
Let's run through these direct comparisons. This is essentially section three of our mental outline. Let's start with insurance. I see variable annuities and variable life insurance on one side of the ledger, and fixed annuities, whole life, and term life on the other. How do we draw the line here?
This is one of the most reliable shortcuts you can use on the Series 63. The golden rule for insurance products comes down to asking one single mechanical question. Who bears the investment risk?
Break that down mechanically. Let's say Dave the dentist is worried about outliving his savings, so he buys a fixed annuity. Where does his money actually go?
When Dave buys a fixed annuity, he gives the insurance company a large lump sum of cash. The insurance company takes Dave's cash and dumps it into their general account.
Okay, the general account.
The general account is a massive pool of money the insurance company uses to buy incredibly safe, conservative investments, usually high-grade corporate bonds and government treasuries. In exchange for Dave's lump sum, the insurance company signs a contract promising to pay Dave a fixed, guaranteed amount of $2,000 every single month for the rest of his life.
Okay, so what happens if the economy completely implodes? Like the stock market crashes 40% and the bonds in the insurance company's general account default?
It does not matter to Dave. The insurance company signed a legal guarantee. Even if the insurance company's investments lose money, they still legally owe Dave his $2,000 a month. The massive, heavily regulated insurance company is bearing 100% of the investment risk.
So Dave is totally safe from the market.
Because Dave is insulated from market fluctuations by that guarantee, the Supreme Court ruled that he does not need the aggressive disclosure and protection of the securities laws. He is already protected by state insurance laws. Therefore, a fixed annuity is not a security.
But Dave gets greedy. He realizes inflation is eating his $2,000 a month. He wants upside potential, so instead he buys a variable annuity.
The mechanics completely change here. When Dave buys a variable annuity, his money does not go into the insurance company's conservative general account.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, his money is placed into a separate account.
A separate account.
Right. The separate account is basically a wrapper that holds a menu of mutual funds, stock funds, growth funds, international equities. Dave gets to choose where his money goes.
So his payout is no longer guaranteed.
Exactly. If the stock market goes on a massive bull run, the mutual funds in Dave's separate account explode in value, and Dave's monthly payout might jump to $4,000. But if the market crashes, Dave's account gets wiped out, and his monthly payout might drop to $500.
Oh, so Dave is bearing the investment risk. His fortunes are directly tied to the performance of the financial markets.
And because Dave, the consumer, is bearing the investment risk, he needs full transparency about what those mutual funds are doing. He needs a prospectus. He needs the protection of the securities regulators. Therefore, a variable annuity, I as a security.
That is such a clean dividing line. If the massive insurance company eats the risk, it's not a security. So that's fixed annuities, whole life, term life. If the individual policyholder eats the risk of market performance, it is a security, variable annuities, variable life. The word variable is your trigger word for security.
Always. Variable equals security.
Let's move to banking products. This is another area where the terminology is deliberately confusing. The exam will ask you to compare a bank CD versus a certificate of deposit for a security. To me, those sound like the exact same thing.
They sound identical, which is why they're a favorite trap. Let's look at the mechanics. A traditional bank CD, a certificate of deposit you get from the teller at your local Chase or Bank of America branch, is a pure banking product. You give the bank $10,000, they lock it up for a year, and they promise you 4% interest.
And if the bank goes under?
Your money is insured by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Because it is a guaranteed banking product with federal insurance backing, it is insulated from market risk. A traditional bank CD is not a security.
Okay, so what in the world is a certificate of deposit for a security?
This is a completely different mechanism that has nothing to do with a retail bank.
How so?
Imagine an American investor, Paula, wants to buy stock in a Japanese manufacturing company. But trading foreign shares directly is legally and logistically complicated. So a massive U.S. financial institution buys millions of shares of the Japanese stock and locks them away in a secure vault. They deposit them in a trust.
Okay, they're in a vault.
Then the U.S. institution issues paper receipts that represent ownership of the shares sitting in that vault. These receipts are called American Depositary Receipts, or ADRs.
Ah. The receipt itself is a certificate of deposit, proving that a specific security is locked in a vault somewhere.
Exactly. Because the certificate merely represents an underlying equity security, the certificate itself takes on the exact same risk profile as the stock. Its value fluctuates with the market. Therefore, a certificate of deposit for a security, IS a security.
Retail bank CD, yeah. Safe, boring, FDIC insured, not a security. CD for a security. A receipt for a fluctuating stock is a security.
I love it.
Let's talk about tangible assets, hard assets. Let's say Dave the dentist gets paranoid about hyperinflation.
Which happens.
Yeah. He puts $100,000 out of his bank account in cash. He drives downtown to a bullion dealer, buys a massive physical gold bar, brings it home, and buries it under the oak tree in his backyard. Did Dave just buy a security?
No. Dave bought a tangible commodity. Physical gold, silver, rare art, vintage cars, antique furniture. These are all tangible personal property. You can hold them in your hand.
So Howie doesn't apply.
If we run it through the Howie test, it fails immediately. There is no common enterprise. Dave isn't pooling his gold with anyone else. And most importantly, Dave isn't relying on the managerial efforts of a third party to generate a profit. The gold is just sitting in the dirt. Its value might go up or down based on global supply and demand, but no promoter is actively managing it for him. Not a security.
But Dave is a dentist. He hates dirt. He doesn't want to dig a hole in his yard, and he doesn't want to pay for a massive home safe. He just wants the financial exposure to the price of gold. So he logs into his brokerage account and buys 1,000 shares of a gold ETF.
The economic exposure is similar, but the legal reality is completely different. Dave didn't buy physical gold. He bought a fractional ownership interest in a massive pooled fund that holds gold on his behalf.
So Howie kicks in.
We're on Howie again. Is there an investment of money? Yes. Is there a common enterprise? Yes. Millions of investors pulled their money into the ETF. Does Dave expect a profit? Yes. Is he relying on the efforts of others? Absolutely. He is relying on the ETF managers to source the gold, secure it in institutional vaults, audit it, and manage the fund's daily operations.
Because Dave's relying on that management structure, the gold ETF is a security.
You got it.
It's the exact same logic for real estate, isn't it?
Precisely. If you buy a physical rental house on your street and manage the tenants yourself, that is direct ownership of tangible property. You are relying on your own efforts to fix the plumbing and collect rent, not a security. But if you take that same money and buy shares in a REIT, a real estate investment trust, you are pooling your money with thousands of other people to let a professional management team buy skyscrapers and shopping malls. You are entirely passive. That is a security.
Okay, listener, I want you to apply this logic right now. Here is your next pop quiz.
Listen closely.
You are reading an exam question. The scenario is, Dave the dentist purchases a membership interest in a newly formed limited liability company, Frank's Flying Ferrets LLC. Is Dave's LLC membership interest considered a security? Pause for a beat. Think about the mechanical test we just used. What does the answer depend on? Pause. Okay, so what's the answer?
It depends entirely on the operating agreement of the LLC, specifically regarding active versus passive management.
How so?
An LLC is a flexible structure. If the agreement is set up so that Dave is merely a passive capital contributor, meaning he provides the money, but Frank is the sole managing member who makes every single business decision, then Dave is completely reliant on the efforts of others.
Right.
Prong four of Howie is met. The LLC interest is an investment contract and therefore a security.
But if the LLC is structured so that Dave is an active managing member, like what if the agreement requires Dave to be on site every day, actively negotiating contracts for the circus tents and managing the finances?
Then Dave is relying heavily on his own entrepreneurial efforts to drive the success of the business. He has real control. Because he has control, he doesn't need the anti-fraud disclosures of the Securities Act to protect him from a shadowy promoter. He is the promoter.
Prong four fails.
Exactly. Yeah. Prong four of Howie fails. In that specific active scenario, the LLC interest is not a security.
I love how logical the law becomes once you understand the underlying machinery. It's not just arbitrary rules. It's a system designed to protect people who hand their money over to someone else and lose control of it.
That's the entire philosophy of the law.
So we've defined our persons. We define exactly what a security is. Now we have to look at the transaction itself. At what exact millisecond does the Uniform Securities Act kick down the door, flash its badge, and say, aha, we have jurisdiction over this interaction?
The law steps in at two distinct phases of a transaction, the offer and the sale. The USA defines them separately, and it regulates them both aggressively.
A sale feels intuitive. I give you cash, you give me a stock certificate, the deal is done.
Legally, a sale or sell is defined as every contract to sell, or disposition of a security or an interest in a security for value.
That phrase for value seems to be doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It is the linchpin of the entire concept. If value, meaning money, property, or taking on a legal obligation, changes hands in exchange for a security, a sale has occurred. The transaction is complete.
Okay, so what is an offer?
An offer or offer to sell is defined as every attempt or offer to dispose of or solicitation of an offer to buy a security or interest in a security for value.
So an offer is just the attempt. It happens before the sale. If the attempt is successful, it blossoms into a sale. Why does the law bother defining the attempt? Why not just regulate the completed sale?
Think about the underlying purpose of the USA, preventing fraud. Imagine Paul the promoter creates a completely fraudulent, worthless stock. She stands on a street corner with a megaphone and starts screaming at elderly pedestrians, offering to sell them this scam stock for $10,000.
Right.
If the law only regulated completed sales, the state securities administrator would have to sit across the street watching Paula scream, completely powerless, until some poor victim actually handed her a check. The regulator would have to wait for the damage to be done before intervening.
That would be absurd.
Huh.
The regulators need to stop her before she steals the money.
Exactly. By explicitly defining an offer as a regulated event, the USA grants the administrator jurisdiction the millisecond. Paula turns on the megaphone. She is attempting to dispose of a security for value. That is an offer.
Wow.
The administrator can immediately issue a cease and desist order and shut her down, even if no money has changed hands yet. You do not have to successfully rob someone to go to jail for attempted robbery.
That makes absolute sense. Regulate the attempt to prevent the harm. Now let's drill down into that linchpin phrase, for value, because this is where the exam writers get incredibly nasty.
Oh, they love this part.
They will present scenarios that don't look like traditional sales to see if you can spot the hidden exchange of value.
Oh.
Let's bring Paula the promoter back in. Paula has a warehouse full of terrible, over-engineered smart toasters that constantly burn bread and randomly disconnect from the Wi-Fi. She's trying to sell them for an outrageous price of $5,000 each.
Good luck with that.
Right. Shockingly, no one is buying them. So Paula needs a gimmick. She runs a massive online ad campaign. Buy this revolutionary $5,000 toaster today, and as a special thank you, I will throw in 1,000 shares of my new tech startup stock, absolutely free E.
Ah, the classic free bonus.
Dave the dentist loves gadgets. He buys the $5,000 toaster. He receives the toaster and a certificate for 1,000 shares of stock. Does the Uniform Securities Act regulate those 1,000 shares? Paula's advertisement explicitly stated they were a free gift.
The USA absolutely regulates those shares because legally they were not free.
Why not?
The drafters of the USA anticipated this exact loophole. The act specifically states that any security given or delivered with, or as a bonus on account of any purchase of securities or any other thing, is considered to constitute part of the subject of the purchase.
The bonus security rule. Because regulators are not stupid. They know Paul is just hiding the price of the stock inside the inflated price of the toaster.
Substance over form. The economic reality is that Dave paid $5,000 for a package deal. The $5,000 consideration covered both the bad toaster and the stock. Value changed hands for the entire package.
I see.
Therefore, the stock is conclusively deemed to have been offered and sold for value. Paula cannot use the word free as a magic spell to bypass securities registration and anti-fraud laws.
If you buy a product and get a free security attached to it, that security was sold. Period. Now let's look at actual gifts, because this leads to my absolute favorite piece of historical trivia in the source material, which sets up a brutal direct comparison trap on the exam. The gift gotcha.
This is a classic Series 63 trick.
Let's say Paula is feeling genuinely generous. It's Dave's birthday. Paula has two different types of stock in her portfolio. She has regular standard stock-like shares of Apple or Microsoft, and she has something historically referred to as accessible stock.
Right.
Before we look at the gift, I want to understand the history here. What on earth is accessible stock? I've traded my whole life, and I've never seen it on a modern brokerage app.
It is incredibly rare today, but you have to go back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly during the mining booms, to understand why it exists.
Okay, mining booms.
Imagine a group of wildcatters wants to dig a silver mine. They form a corporation and issue stock to raise capital. But mining is wildly unpredictable. They might run out of money before they hit the silver vein.
Right. They need more cash.
To protect themselves, they issue assessable stock. They might tell investors the par value of this stock is $100, but today you only have to pay us $10 a share. However, by buying this stock, you agree that if the company runs low on cash in the future, the board of directors has the legal right to levy an assessment, a mandatory capital call demanding that you pay the remaining $90.
Wow. So owning the stock is essentially signing a blank check for future liability.
Exactly. If the company levies an assessment and you refuse to pay it, the company can legally confiscate your shares or even sue you personally for the unpaid balance. Assessable stock comes attached to a potential financial time bomb.
Okay, with that mechanical context, let's look at Bola's gift.
Yeah.
Bola takes new 100 shares of assessable stock from a struggling mining company, puts a nice birthday bow on it, and gifts it to Dave. Dave accepts the certificate. He pays Paula's $0. Is that gift considered a sale under the Uniform Securities Act?
Yes. Under the USA, a gift of assessable stock, IS, an offer, and a sale.
But Dave didn't pay her anything. The definition of a sale requires a disposition for value. Where is the value exchange if no money changed hands?
The value is the legal obligation Dave just unknowingly accepted. By taking ownership of the assessable stock, Dave stepped into Paula's shoes. He is now the one on the hook if the mining company levies an assessment.
Oh, man.
Paula essentially just transferred a potential debt, a massive liability, onto Dave to get it off her own books. Because Dave accepted a potential financial burden in exchange for the asset, the law views that assumption of liability as value.
That's sneaky.
Therefore, it is a sale, and the regulators have jurisdiction to ensure Paula isn't fraudulently gifting toxic debt bombs to unsuspecting people.
That is fascinating. Okay, what if Paula gives Dave a birthday present of standard, normal, non-assessable stock? Just 100 regular shares of a tech company that has no right to demand future capital.
In that case, it is a true, bona fide gift. Nothing of value moves in either direction. Dave pays nothing today, and the company can never demand money from him tomorrow. Because there is no exchange of value and no assumption of liability, a gift of non-assessable stock is not a sale.
Let's cement this comparison for the listener. A gift of assessable stock, IS, a sale. A gift of non-assessable stock is not a sale. The exam will put both options in the same multiple choice question. Know the mechanical difference.
Memorize that rule.
Okay, what else does not count as a sale? The source material outlines several specific transactions that look like securities changing hands, but the USA explicitly excludes them from the definition of a sale to protect normal business operations.
Yes, there are vital exclusions. The most tested one is a bona fide pledge or loan.
Let's run a scenario. Dave, the dentist, wants to expand his practice. He needs $200,000 to buy new x-ray equipment. He goes to his local bank for a business loan. The bank says, "We will lend you the money, but we need collateral."
Very standard.
Dave has a massive portfolio of blue chip stocks. He agrees to pledge $300,000 worth of his stock portfolio as collateral for the loan. He signs the paperwork temporarily transferring control of those shares to the bank. Has Dave sold his stock to the bank?
No. Pledging securities as collateral for a bona fide loan is explicitly excluded from the definition of a sale.
Because he still basically owns them.
Exactly. Mechanically, Dave is not disposing of the asset for value. He still retains the economic upside and downside of the stock. If the stock doubles in value while sitting in the bank's collateral vault, Dave gets the benefit. He is merely using it as a security blanket for the lender. Because it's just a pledge, it's not a sale.
Okay, but I see the exam trap forming here. Let's fast forward 2 years. The new x-ray equipment is a disaster. Dave's practice goes under. He completely defaults on the $200,000 loan.
Fine.
The bank gets angry. They execute their rights under the pledge agreement. They foreclose on the collateral. And they liquidate Dave's stock. They sell it on the open stock exchange to recover their $200,000.
That subsequent foreclosure and liquidation,
okay.
That is a sale under the USA.
It's a two-step timeline. Step one, the pledge, not a sale. Step two, the foreclosure, is a sale.
The exam writers love testing your ability to read the timeline of a scenario carefully. You have to read to the very end of the paragraph to see if the transaction stops at the initial pledge or if it progresses all the way to a default and foreclosure.
Got it. Another major exclusion is a stock dividend. Frank's Flying Ferrets is actually having a highly profitable year, but Frank wants to keep the cash in the company to buy more trapezes. So instead of mailing out cash dividends to his shareholders, the board of directors authorizes a 10% stock dividend.
Right. Very common.
Every investor who owns 100 shares winks up to find 110 shares in their account. Is Frank's company selling them those 10 extra shares?
No. A standard stock dividend is explicitly excluded from being an offer or a sale. Look at the mechanics of value. The stockholders did not reach into their pockets and pay Frank any new money to receive those extra shares.
Right, they just appeared.
Furthermore, the overall value of the company didn't change. It was just sliced into smaller pieces. Because the investors gave nothing of value to receive the dividend, no sale occurred.
But wait, let me push back on this because there is a nuance here that feels like a trap.
Yeah.
What if Frank gives the investors a choice? He sends out a notice saying, you can either elect to receive a $500 cash dividend this quarter, or you can check this box to receive 10 extra shares of stock instead.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Dave the dentist gets the notice. He really wants the cash to buy a new TV. But he thinks about it, decides the stock is a better long-term play, signs the form giving up his right to the $500 cash, and takes the shares instead. Didn't Dave just effectively pay for those shares by surrendering his legal right to $500 in cash? That sounds like an exchange of value.
That is an incredibly logical legal argument. You are thinking exactly like an aggressive regulator.
Thank you.
However, the drafters of the Uniform Securities Act explicitly decided not to go down that road because it would create an administrative nightmare for every corporation in America trying to issue flexible dividends.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The USA contains a specific statutory carve-out for this exact scenario. It states that any act incident to a class vote by stockholders or a transaction involving a judicially approved reorganization, or crucially, the issuance of stock under a cash or stock dividend election is not considered a sale.
Wow. So even though Dave gave up his right to cash, the law creates a protective bubble around corporate dividend elections. Surrendering the cash option does not legally equal giving value. It is still excluded. It is not a sale.
Correct. The only conceivable way a stock dividend becomes a sale is if the corporation requires the stockholders to actually pay additional fresh consideration out of pocket to receive the shares, which defeats the entire purpose of a dividend.
We are covering a massive amount of ground, and the structural logic of this law is really coming into focus. We have defined the persons. We know what a security is. We know exactly what constitutes an offer and a sale. Now we move to the final piece of the puzzle.
Section 5.
Section 5 of our mental map. Issuers, non-issuers, and roles. This section is entirely about mapping the flow of money. It is about figuring out who is standing where, when the music stops, whose bank account gets larger, and what specific regulatory hat everyone is wearing.
And understanding the flow of money here is vital because the distinction between an issuer transaction and a non-issuer transaction fundamentally changes how a security must be registered, what exemptions are available, and how much scrutiny the state administrator applies.
Let's start with an issuer transaction. The source material defines this as a transaction in the primary market, where the proceeds of the sale benefit the issuer directly or indirectly. The core concept is that the company is raising capital for itself. Give me a mechanical example.
The clearest example of an issuer transaction is an initial public offering, or IPO. Frank's Flying Ferrets has become a national sensation. Frank decides to take the company public to build a massive permanent arena. The corporation authorizes the creation of 1 million brand new shares of stock.
Yeah.
Through an underwriter, the company sells these new shares to the public for $20 a share. Retail investors hand over $20 million. That $20 million goes directly into the corporate bank account of Frank's Flying Ferrets, Inc.
The entity that issued the security is the entity that received the cash.
Exactly. The transaction directly benefited the issuer. Therefore, it is an issuer transaction.
Now, fast forward a year. The IPO was a success. Dave the dentist bought 1,000 shares during the IPO. But a year later, Dave is tired of the volatility. He wants to buy a boat. Dave logs into his Charles Schwab account and hits the sell button. His broker routes the order to the New York Stock Exchange. On the other side of the country, Paula the promoter happens to be buying. The exchange matches them up. Paula pays $25,000, and Dave's 1,000 shares are transferred to Paula's account. Does Frank's corporate bank account receive any money from that trade between Dave and Paula?
Not a single cent. Frank's company already got their capital during the IPO. This new trade is occurring in the secondary market.
Because it's investor to investor.
Yes. Because the proceeds of the sale went to Dave, and the transaction did not benefit the issuer directly or indirectly, the law classifies it as a non-issuer transaction.
It really is that simple. If the company gets the cash, it's an issuer transaction.
Yeah.
If the investors are just trading amongst themselves and the company gets nothing, it's a non-issuer transaction.
As a fundamental baseline, yes. Follow the money. But you have to be careful with terminology because the financial industry uses slang that can confuse the legal definitions. The exam might try to trick you by introducing the term secondary offering.
Oh, I've heard that on CNBC. A company does an IPO, and then a year later they do a secondary offering. That sounds like an issuer transaction because it's a big corporate event.
And that is exactly why it's a trap. Let's look at the mechanics of a true secondary offering. Frank, the founder, personally owns 500,000 shares of Ferret stock from when he started the company in his garage. Now that the stock is public and trading high, Frank wants to buy a mansion.
Okay, so Frank needs cash.
Frank hires a massive investment bank to help him sell a huge chunk of his personally owned shares to the public all at once. This massive block sale is called a secondary offering. Where does the money go? It goes into Frank's personal private checking account so he can buy his mansion. It does not go into the company's treasury.
Ah. Because the corporation itself did not receive the proceeds, even a massive, highly publicized secondary offering by the founder is technically a non-issuer transaction under the USA.
Exactly. You always have to trace the proceeds. If the company issues new shares to raise more corporate capital later on, which is properly called a follow-on offering, that money goes to the company, making it an issuer transaction.
Follow the money. Now, here is where it gets incredibly strange, and I need you to explain this because the exam tests these weird exceptions relentlessly.
Okay, let's hear it.
There are a few highly specific securities where identifying the issuer isn't as simple as looking at the company name printed on the stock certificate. Let's start with the strangest one. The source material notes a specific rule for certificates of interest or participation in oil, gas, or mining titles or leases. If I buy a participation interest in a Texas oil well, who does the USA define as the issuer?
Under the strict definition of the Uniform Securities Act, for those specific oil, gas, and mining interests, there is no issuer.
Why none? How can a security exist without an issuer? Someone had to print the paper and take my money.
You have to look at the history of how these interests were created. Historically, wildcatters would prospect for oil on a massive plot of land. To fund the drilling, they wouldn't form a traditional corporation with the board of directors.
What would they do?
Instead, they would just take the legal lease for the land and slice it up into dozens of fractional undivided interests. They would sell you a 164th interest in whatever oil happened to bubble out of that specific hole in the ground.
So there is no corporate entity. It's just a raw fractional property.
Exactly. Right? Because there is no traditional corporate structure, no board of directors, and no continuous business entity operating beyond that one hole in the ground, the drafters of the USA threw their hands up. They decided it was legally impossible to pinpoint a traditional issuer for these fractional leases. So the statute explicitly declares that for oil, gas, and mining certificates of interest, there is no issuer.
Okay, that is great historical trivia. But how does that actually impact a candidate taking the Series 63 exam? Why does knowing there is no issuer matter?
Because it creates a massive domino effect for how the security can be legally sold. There is a streamlined, relatively easy method of registering securities with a state called registration by filing or notification.
Right.
But to qualify for this easy method, the law requires the security to have a highly qualified, financially stable, massive corporate issuer with a long track record of profitability.
Oh, I see the connective logic. If the statute legally declares that an oil and gas interest has no issuer, then it is physically impossible for them to meet the qualifications for the easy registration by filing.
Exactly. They are locked out of the easy path. Promoters of oil and gas interests must use much more rigorous, expensive methods of registration like coordination or qualification, where the state administrator intensely scrutinizes the offering. The no issuer rule is a mechanism to enforce stricter oversight on highly speculative drilling ventures.
That is brilliant. Understanding the why makes memorizing the rules so much easier. What about trusts? We talked about certificates of deposit for a security earlier. The ADR is held in a vault. And the source also mentions voting trust certificates and collateral trust certificates. Who is the issuer there?
For these specific trust-based securities, where there is no board of directors to point to, the law designates the issuer as the depositor or the manager.
So it looks past the abstract trust entity itself and identifies the actual human being or financial firm that is pulling the levers, depositing the assets, and managing the structure.
Yes. The person performing the acts and assuming the duties of the manager under the trust agreement is legally held responsible as the issuer.
Okay, the final major topic we need to master is role identification. The Series 63 exam loves to present a short narrative scenario about a financial transaction and ask. In this scenario, is John acting as a broker-dealer an agent, a dealer, or an issuer. If you don't have these mechanics straight, the scenarios blur together. Let's define the four core hats someone can wear in a transaction.
We already deeply understand the first hat, the issuer.
Right.
The issuer is the entity that creates the security, requires the capital, files the registration paperwork, and receives the proceeds in a primary transaction. Frank's Flying Ferrets, Inc. is the issuer.
Easy. What is a broker-dealer?
A broker-dealer, or BD, is the financial firm hired to distribute the securities to the public or to facilitate trading in the secondary market. Crucially, a broker-dealer is almost always an entity, a corporation, or a partnership. Think of a massive Wall Street firm like Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs.
So the business itself.
Yes. They are the institutional middlemen bridging the gap between issuers and investors, or between buyers and sellers.
Big firm equals broker-dealer. So what is an agent?
An agent is an individual, a natural, breathing human being. The agent is the individual who represents a broker-dealer, or sometimes an issuer in actually affecting or attempting to affect purchases or sales of securities.
So if I call my massive Wall Street broker-dealer firm to buy 100 shares of Apple, the firm itself is the broker-dealer. But the human employee who picks up the phone confirms my order and hits the execute button on their terminal. That human being is acting as the agent.
Precisely. The firm is the BD. The individual employee representing the firm to the client is the agent.
Okay, that leaves the most confusing distinction. The term is broker-dealer, which implies two different functions smashed together. What is the mechanical difference between acting as a broker versus acting as a dealer?
This relies entirely on how the firm handles the inventory of the trade. Let's say Dave wants to buy 1,000 shares of Ferret stock. He calls his firm. If the firm acts as a broker, they act in an agency capacity.
Meaning?
The firm says, Dave, we don't own any Ferret stock ourselves, but hold on, let us go out into the public market, find a seller, and match you up with them. The firm finds Paula, who is selling. They connect Dave and Paula. For providing this matchmaking service, the firm charges Dave a commission.
Like a real estate broker. A real estate broker doesn't own the houses they sell. They just match a buyer with a seller and take a cut.
Perfect analogy. That is acting as a broker. Now, let's look at acting as a dealer. Dave calls the firm to buy 1,000 shares. The firm says, Dave, you're in luck. We actually bought 50,000 shares of Ferret stock yesterday with our own corporate money, and we have them sitting in our own vault. We will sell you 1,000 shares directly out of our own inventory.
Oh, I see.
In this scenario, the firm is acting as a principal. They are trading from their own account. They don't charge a commission. Instead, they make money by charging Dave a slight markup on the price of the stock.
Like a used car dealership, the car dealer buys cars with their own money, puts them on their own lot, and sells them directly to you from their inventory for a profit.
Exactly. Broker equals matchmaker agency capacity, earns a commission. Dealer equals MERD. Trading from their own inventory principal capacity earns a markup or markdown. The vast majority of large financial firms perform both functions depending on the specific trade, which is why they are legally registered as broker-dealers. But the exam will ask you to identify which specific capacity they are acting in during a given scenario.
And there was one final trap the source material warns about regarding role identification. The multiple choice options might throw the term rating agency into the mix, like Moody's, Standard & Poor's, or Fitch.
A rating agency is an entirely separate, independent third party. They do not issue securities. They do not distribute securities. They do not execute trades. All they do is analyze a company's debt and assign a credit rating like AAA or BBB to give investors an idea of default risk.
So they're just an observer.
Exactly. If you see rating agency listed as an option in a role identification question on the Series 63, it is almost certainly a distractor designed to confuse you. Ignore it.
Amazing. Okay, listener, take a deep breath. We have dismantled the absolute core vocabulary of the Uniform Securities Act. We've explored the massive regulatory net of personhood, the mechanical four-pronged Howey test for securities, the aggressive timeline of offers and sales, and the money flow logic of issuers and broker-dealers.
It's a lot, but it's the foundation of everything.
You have the mechanical foundation. Now we are heading into the outro. It is time for the rapid-fire recap.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to throw the concepts at our expert, and we are going to drill the top testable takeaways into your brain one last time. Let's go.
Ready.
The definition of a person. The exam asks if a minor, a deceased individual, or a mentally incompetent adult is a person.
They are still a person. The statutory definition does not exclude them. Do not confuse statutory personhood with the legal capacity to sign a contract.
The Howey test. A promoter guarantees a profit. but the investor has to do 50% of the daily labor to manage the business. Is it a security?
No. All four prongs must be met. If the investor is providing substantial managerial effort, prong four fails. It is not an investment contract.
Direct comparison. A fixed annuity versus a variable annuity.
Follow the risk. In a variable annuity, the policyholder's money is in a separate account and they bear the market risk. Therefore, it is a security. In a fixed annuity, the insurance company bears the risk from their general account, therefore not a security.
Paula sells Dave a $5,000 toaster and throws in 100 shares of stock as a free bonus.
It is an offer and a sale for value. The USA explicitly states that bonus securities are part of the purchase price. Value was exchanged.
The gift, gotcha. Paula gives Dave assessable stock versus non-assessable stock.
A gift of assessable stock, IS a sale, because it transfers a potential future financial liability to the recipient, which counts as value. A gift of non-assessable stock is a true gift and is not a sale.
Tricky issuers. You buy a fractional certificate of interest in a Texas oil lease. Who is the issuer?
The law explicitly states there is no issuer for oil, gas, and mining interests, preventing them from using easy registration methods.
The collateral trap. Dave pledges his stock to a bank to secure a loan.
The initial pledge is explicitly excluded. It is not a sale. But if Dave defaults and the bank forecloses and liquidates the stock, that subsequent liquidation, IS, a sale.
And finally, broker versus dealer.
A broker acts as an agent, matching buyers and sellers for a commission. A dealer acts as a principal, trading directly from their own inventory for a markup.
Boom! You've got it. That is the architecture of the Uniform Securities Act.
You know, before we sign off, this entire deep dive raises a really fascinating question, something for you to mull over as you close your books for the day.
Okay, what is it?
Well, we spent a lot of time analyzing the 1946 Howey test. We talked about a dispute over Florida orange groves that was settled by the Supreme Court 80 years ago. But that 80-year-old logic is exactly what governs today's most complex, cutting-edge digital assets.
It's the exact same framework.
It is. As you move through your day, look closely at the digital world around you. Think about those apps where you can buy fractional ownership of a rare pair of vintage sneakers stored in a vault somewhere.
Right.
Or think about the volatile in-game currency your kids are buying to upgrade their digital avatars. Think about the social media influencers selling exclusive access tokens that promise future revenue shares of their brand.
All that stuff is everywhere now.
The law demands substance over form, economic reality over the label. Look under the surface of these modern platforms. Run them through the four prongs of Howey. Is there an investment of money, a common enterprise, an expectation of profit, a reliance on the efforts of the platform developers?
Cool.
How much of our modern unregulated digital life is secretly just an unregistered security sitting there waiting for the regulators to finally catch up?
That is a brilliant way to frame it. It proves that this isn't just dry history you have to memorize for a test. This law is alive,
yeah,
and it's actively shaping the financial technology of the future right now.
It absolutely is.
All right, listener, take a breath. You are doing great. I know this is a massive amount of dense material, but you are putting in the work to understand the underlying mechanics, not just memorizing flashcards. Trust your studying. Trust the process. You are now armed with the exact legal vocabulary required to crush the rest of the USA material on the Series 63.
The diagnostic waters are significantly clearer now.
Exactly. You broke your arm, we finally got the X-ray machine working, and we found the jagged line. We know exactly what we are looking at. You've got this. Keep moving forward.